As I said, this morning we do come to a passage that is controversial in its content, to say the least. This is a topic that is, in some circles, is extremely volatile. And I want to tell you up front, I make no apologies, and I'm not going to soft-pedal the commands communicated in this passage. This is what Scripture teaches. And the culture of feminism has permeated society. It has impacted and infected the church. And that impacts our understanding in the way that we view this passage. And I will say as well, up front, I recognize the traditional biblical roles have certainly been abused. There are absolutely horror stories of those, you know, that could be stated of those that have abused the biblical roles, but the corrective to an abuse of a biblical role is not rejecting the biblical role. The corrective is to get in the biblical role. And I would say as well, despite the current cultural controversy and even despite the recent changes in churches, up until the last, well, it's less than 100 years, I would say potentially the last 60 years, but up until the last 100 years, the Christian church across the board has held a consistent view on these matters. And so what I'm going to preach today is absolutely biblical, and it is the historical position of the church. It has only been since the middle of the 20th century that there has been a radical revision of that position. And so buckle your seatbelts this morning. We're going to delve into the role of ladies in the church. And it begins with, this section really begins with verse 8. Verse 8 is a transitional statement as Paul is moving. Really, all of chapter 2 is the same theme, but Paul is moving from discussion of prayer in general to now moving into specific application of how to further the gospel and how to further godliness. And verse 8 is a continuation of what Paul says in verse 1, as he says in chapter 2, verse 1, "I exhort, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men." Verse 8, he says, "I will, therefore, that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting." In the intervening verses between verses 2 through 7, Paul has spent those verses telling the believers why they ought to pray. And as we looked at over the last couple weeks, they are to pray, and to pray in this fashion, primarily for the promotion of godliness and the propagation of the gospel. That is what he's focusing in on. He says, pray particularly for kings and for all in authority, that you may be godly, that we may lead godly lives, and that the gospel will go forward, because God is willing that all will come to the knowledge of truth. And so he says here, now in verse 8, he makes that command very specific to the men. As I said last week, in the original, in the Greek, there is a "the" before the word "men." So what Paul says is, "I will therefore that the men pray everywhere." Paul is speaking directly to the men and telling them they are responsible to pray in this fashion for the accomplishment of these goals. And time did not allow me last week to delve deeply into those verses, and so I'm just going to simply reiterate again what Paul is saying. Men, you are responsible to be praying. You are specifically, uniquely commanded to be praying. We often think of prayer as that which is done by the grandmothers of the past eras. And there's at times a subtle idea that prayer is woman's work. And our culture even has somehow propagated that a little bit. Prayer is your task, men. You are to be praying. You must be praying. You are to be praying in all places. Prayer really must characterize your life. You are commanded to be men of prayer. That is what verse 8 says. Because God's desires that all men will be saved, Paul says, pray. Men, pray. Because we want to promote godliness, we want to live godly lives, men, pray. That is the command that is given to you, very particularly, very uniquely. Not that women are forbidden prayer, but that men, you are uniquely expected to pray. And then the rest of this passage, Paul gears to the lady. So men, you can spend the rest of this message meditating on verse 8, because the rest of what I'm going to say really doesn't apply to you. So put your earplugs in and think about verse 8 and how you're not doing it. The rest of the passage, he begins now to deal with the role of ladies. And so as Paul commands the men to be in prayer so that godliness will be promoted and the gospel will be preached, the women are given very specific commands for the same purposes. And so what we see here, verse 1, again, to kind of give you the picture of the passage, is a blanket command to all believers for godliness and the spread of the gospel. Verses 8 to 10 are giving specific instructions to men and to women to help further the godly ends mentioned, and he also uses it to transition into the matters of church function, so that beginning in chapter 11, moving down to verse 15 of chapter 3, beginning of verse 11, moving down to verse 15 of chapter 3, Paul is dealing particularly with the functions within the church. And so what Paul says here, to go back to verse 9 and 10, Paul is saying to further godly living and for the spread of the gospel, ladies, you must dress and carry yourselves properly. There are two issues at stake in this verse. One is outward and the other is inward. Neither is less important than the other. The outward issue is that which we typically call modesty. And as he says this, verse 9, he says, in like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel. The emphasis in the modest apparel is he's not addressing sensuality in the dress. Now that it has its place in this conversation, but in this passage, Paul is not addressing sensuality in the dress. So as I talk about modesty, and you see the word modest there, we're not talking about too tight, too low, too high, or any of that. We're talking about something else, and something that is just as significant. And I think this conversation on modesty ends up focused only on sensuality and completely misses a major aspect and the point that Paul is making here. What Paul says what Paul tells them is to and forbids them to do is to dress in a way that is flashy and showy. His command is, his instruction is that you dress modestly, not with, the phrases he uses, broided hair, gold or pearls, or costly array. Now, in the culture at that time, the ladies, to show off their wealth, they would go really to some great lengths. One of the things they would do was they would weave gold and silver strands into their hair, braiding it with these precious metals. That's what he's talking about when he says braided hair. It's not just braiding your hair in general. It is talking about this weaving in of the gold and silver into the hairdo to show the vast wealth that these ladies had. Likewise, they would cover themselves, adorn themselves with gold and pearls. And again, not like the little trinkets we see today with little earrings or a necklace or something. They would sometimes go to great lengths to adorn themselves so that their arms would be almost covered with gold and be just a vast display of their wealth. Maybe a similar cultural idea would be, sometimes you see men that want to show off their wealth and they've got rings on all 10 fingers. And it's huge rings, not just little bands, but a huge ring on all their fingers. And that's the concept of what Paul is talking about. He's forbidding them from dressing in a fashion that is, it is designed to impress or to show off their worth and their wealth. Instead, your dress must reflect your salvation. Instead of reflecting your bank account, it is reflecting your relationship with Christ. The point Paul is making is that you dress in such a way that you are showing, as he says there in the parentheses, that which becometh women professing godliness. You're dressing in a way that is fitting for your claim to be a child of God. You're dressing in a way that you're showing you're devoted to living in a fashion that pleases God. That your dress reflects your desire to exalt God. So that, to go back to verse 8, where Paul forbids the prayer with anger, an angry man is absolutely a hindrance to the furtherance of the gospel, as well a flashy woman, a lady that is dressing to show off her value or her great style or her greater judgment in dress is just as much a hindrance to the gospel. And the point is that your clothes are absolutely a part of your testimony, that you dress not to impress others. You dress to point others to Christ. That you look at your wardrobe from a different, completely different perspective. That you look at your wardrobe and say, how does this further the gospel? How does this show godliness? How does this show the glory of God? That's the matter at stake. It's not to show that, hey, I can shop at these stores, or I have this great taste, or I can find these things. It is to show the gospel. And so Paul, on the other side of that, he says dress and rightly, not just, again, it's not just enough, okay, I've got the right clothes and everybody approves of the clothes that I'm wearing. It doesn't concern anybody. It seems to be properly godly and pious and all of that. There's an inward aspect that is just as important. So that instead of putting on showy, self-serving clothing, Paul says to put on respectfulness, sound thinking, and good works. So instead of putting on clothes to impress, you put on an attitude and a demeanor that reflects godliness. Paul says put on respectfulness. That word there in verse 9, shamefacedness. It comes from a Greek root word that means with downcast eyes. So that instead of a proud, arrogant look, the godly woman is respectful and is humble. Instead of frivolousness, she puts on sobriety, which is a right thinking, a sound mind that looks at the world through the grid of Scriptures. It's not that which is turned about by every fad or every notion, but it is that which is really right thinking. And instead of a wasteful showiness, instead of flaunting of wealth, to put on good works. Verse 10 there. They put on the good works instead of showing off the wealth, using what they are given and what they possess, the resources that God has entrusted with for the ministry and service of others. Ephesians 2:10 tells us that we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works. Titus 3 says that they which have believed in God might be careful to maintain good works. And says later, let ours also learn to maintain good works. This aspect of good works is a basic expectation of every believer. We have been saved to go out and to do that which is a genuine benefit to somebody else. to do that which fills a genuine need. This really is charity in its truest form. It is that of going out and working on somebody else's behalf to give them something they genuinely need that they cannot provide for themselves. The lady that professes godliness must have a demeanor and a dress that matches that profession. A dress that is appropriate. It's not proud. It's not extravagant. A demeanor that is respectful and sober-minded, so that in all things your dress and your attitude is fitting for your profession of godliness. That just as much as you might be concerned about what's in your closet, you are as deeply concerned about what's in your heart. That just as much as what you may be concerned about how others are seeing what you're wearing, you're just as concerned about how your testimony of godliness to others, that you're looking and examining and saying, am I respectful? Am I sober-minded? Am I anxious and ready for good works? That is the emphasis Paul is driving at to further the gospel, to promote godliness. These are not just, you know, again, just standing alone by themselves, and so that, you know, we say, hey, look at what a good job they did. These have a greater end in mind, that you dress and behave in such a way that the gospel will be furthered, that godliness will be promoted. And so in verses 8 through 10, Paul describes the actions of believing men and women that will further godliness and the spread of the gospel, and that discussion bridges into the proper behavior of women in the public gathering in the church of the church. And what Paul says in verses 11 and 12 is that the women are not to teach in the corporate gatherings or the general assembly, nor are they to exercise authority over the congregation. Now this immediately runs afoul of all liberated notions about the role of women in the world today. And just in case you're wondering, frankly, I don't care what the world's opinion of the passage is. It's not what's at stake. What's at stake is the biblical truth. I care what God has said. And there are many that try to get around the statements of these two verses. And because they are very clear statements. I mean, there really is the very plain statements, and the two ways that most people try to get around these is to deny they mean what they mean, to try to change the meanings of these statements. But to do that, you have to go against the clarity of the language. You have to make Paul say something other than what a normal reading would cause you to think he was saying. You have to basically make Paul speaking in code in these two verses to make him mean something other than what it actually means. And again, up until the mid-1900s, there was no serious debate about the meaning of Paul's words in verses 11 and 12. So if you're curious about, you know, how valid the understanding of this passage is, as far as I know, every major Christian denomination, church, however you want to word it, throughout history up until the 1900s, understood this to mean exactly what I said, just said, that women are not to teach the corporate assembly, nor are they to exercise authority over the church body. That's what the church has always understood it mean up till the last 60 or 70 years or so. The other option is to simply say, I don't believe that. And one of the ways that has gotten around to say, well, that is cultural. That Paul was just talking to the city in Ephesus there, and that's just a cultural statement. And I do not have time to go through that argument this morning, but there is no valid reason to say it's only cultural. There's not one. And what it gets down to is someone coming to it with the idea already in mind that this is not a valid statement, and that we're looking for a means to reject it. And the option is to deny it means what it means, or to just simply say, I don't believe that. And really, you might as well be honest and just say, I'm going to refuse to obey any passage I don't like. Because that's what it's getting down to. And Paul gives two simple instructions in these verses. They're really very clear. Verse 11, Paul states women are to learn in submissive silence. That's the overarching thing. And then he explains what submissive silence looks like. And here's these two instructions. They're not to teach. They're not to usurp authority over the man. And so what verse 11, what submissive silence looks like is that it is not to teach. And again, I don't have time to work through the whole process of thought here. But what it's pointing to is not teaching the entirety of the congregation, not teaching the mixed assembly. The Scriptures absolutely commands women to teach. Titus chapter 2 is a clear command to all of the older women to teach the younger women. There is a clear instructions regarding teaching. So this is not a prohibition against all women teaching anything. He's forbidding women to teach in the general assembly. So that at no time is a lady to teach the congregation. Now, I'll give you an illustration. A number of years ago, I was watching a video of a lady that was teaching, and she went into this church, and it was Sunday morning, and the pastor announced her and said, "I've invited so-and-so to come and to teach." And this was a independent fundamental Baptist church. You know, we would expect to not have ladies teaching and preaching. And so he had to explain why he had asked her to come up and to speak on that Sunday morning to the entire congregation. His logic was, she is not preaching, she's just going to teach. And I think there was an overhead projector beside her, and I think he even pointed out and said, "See, there's an overhead. She's not preaching, she's teaching." And the command here is none of that. None of that. Not to teach, not just a prohibition against preaching, but a prohibition against all teaching of the General Assembly. Period. The Scriptures limits the preaching and teaching of the Word to the entire church. It limits that only to those men specifically qualified and gifted for the task. And let me say, this does not deny the intellect or the teaching ability of ladies. I know ladies that are phenomenal teachers. I think Ruth is a far better teacher than I am. On topics like this, I'd be very tempted to let her come up and teach it. I'd go sit in the sound booth. That's not the point, though. Ruth has the skill, the experience in teaching. I believe she has gifting related to teaching. She definitely has sound knowledge of the Bible. I would not be worried about how she would teach the passage, but none of that is the point. She is not to be, nor will she, teach the congregation. This command is very plain. Ladies are not to teach and to teach in the general assembly. The second part is that they are not to exercise authority over the church. So again, leadership over the entire congregation is limited to men. So as we're going to see next week, as we get to chapter 3, that means only men can be pastors. And again, this has nothing to do with the administrative qualification, spiritual discernment, the intellectuality or talent or ability of any of the ladies. This had nothing to do with saying they can't, they're incapable. Because once again, frankly, I think there are a number of ladies that would be far superior pastors than some of the pastors I bumped into. And that's not the point. The point is the biblical role that has been defined by God. And this command reflects the original design of God for the roles of men and women. And the King James says usurp authority. And really the understanding of that word there, it's one word that's translated in two, is just simply exercise authority. Now, the word usurp conveys the idea of holding without right, which is what Paul is talking about. Women holding an authority in the church to which they had absolutely no right. So what verses 11 and 12 say is that God has restricted the teaching of the general assemblies and the leadership in the church to men. Now let me pause here before I move to the next couple verses. In the greater context of 1 Timothy, Paul is addressing false teachers that have come in. This is one of the things that he is confronting. He is giving these instructions to tell the church how to operate properly as part of the protection against false teachers. And so as we're thinking about this, let me just give you a very simple blanket statement that you can apply at all times and in all places. If a lady is pastoring a church, she's in sin, she's a false teacher. Period. She may be immensely popular. She may have her own TV show. She may have several TV shows. She may have a multi-million dollar empire. If she is pastoring a church, she is in sin and she is a false teacher. Period. And I would take it to this point and simply say, turn the TV off, turn the radio off, don't buy her CDs, books, or any of the other stuff that she may or may not be selling. It is a clear violation of biblical instructions. It's clearly a violation of the warnings Paul is giving to protect against false teachers. And now verses 13 and 14, Paul gives the reasons for this. And this is one of the reasons why you cannot say this is just limited in its application to the church in Ephesus, because Paul gives the reason for this in a completely cross-cultural argument. He ties the reason for this back to creation and to sin. And so the wife's responsibility to submit in the marriage is directly related to the order of creation. 1 Corinthians 11, Paul connects those dots. But the argument is very simple. Adam was created first and thus was given the authority in the relationship. That's the biblical truth. In the home, the husband is given the headship. Again, not because he deserves it, it's better equipped to administer it or any of that, but because God has designed marriage to operate in that fashion. And similarly, in the church, men have been given headship. Paul uses that same argument. Adam was first formed, then Eve. He says, women are to not teach the general assembly, not to exercise authority over the congregation, because Adam was first formed, then Eve. That is the way that God has designed it. Men lead the church because God created the man first, and that's what the biblical instruction is. Secondly, Paul says men lead because Eve was deceived and consequently fell into sin. Now, just in case you're wondering, this is not suggesting that Adam was without sin or that Adam was somehow less to blame. In fact, you read other Paul's writings and Adam is more to blame. That's not the point of what Paul is saying, but he is saying Eve was deceived and was led into sin. Her deception led her to sin, and so that part of the penalty, if we were to go back to Genesis chapter 3, part of the penalty of that sin is felt in the relationship to the husband. And so that now what was and should have been an amicable relationship, now there is conflict as the husband does not rule as he ought and the wife does not submit as she ought. And as well, that is felt also within the church as the wife is to be, or as the woman is to be submitted to those men that God has placed over the church. And let me say a couple things. With this, I have to put a whole bunch of disclaimers this morning to help us understand it properly. This, again, has nothing to do with suggesting that women are less capable. There have been at times people that have used verse 14 to say women are more easily tricked. That's why men are in leadership. That's not what Paul's saying. Paul is not in saying that women have a higher degree of gullibility. That's not what he's addressing at all. And where he's also not addressing a total submission of every lady to every man. Ladies, you are commanded to submit yourselves to your husbands, to your pastors, and to every legitimate authority in your lives. Those legitimate authorities do not absolutely do not include every man on the planet or even every man in the church. So don't misunderstand what he's saying here. He is not saying giving a blanket submission that all women submit themselves to every man in the church. You know, there's a mutual submission in Ephesians 5:21, but we're not going to deal with that right this morning. That's a different notion. This kind of submission that he is talking about is to the leadership in the church. It is a submission that forbids women from being in the position of leadership, but it does not put them in a position of subjection to every male member of the congregation. And so don't misunderstand the force of the command. But also, if you think about what I'm saying here, you may have also realized this puts a whole lot of the men in essentially the same position as the ladies. Because every man in the church is commanded to be in submission to the pastor's authority in the church. And as we're going to see next week, there are men that are absolutely excluded from leadership in the church. So just because a man is talented, able, or knowledgeable does not automatically give him the right to become a leader in the church. Leadership is limited to those who meet all of the qualifications. And this role, these two roles that are described, are directly connected to creation, to the original plan of God in forming Adam and Eve before sin ever came into the world, and it has been carried through. We see it carried through throughout scriptures, and we see these roles reiterated and repeated several times throughout scriptures, and the task for us is to come to scriptures and to submit ourselves to scriptures that we be operating properly as a church. And then Paul moves from the ladies' necessity of submissive silence in the church to a glorious statement in verse 15. Now, let me say, as much as I think it's a wonderful statement, this is a very difficult verse. In fact, I think it is one of the most difficult verses in the whole Bible to translate and to understand properly. And so before I tell you my understanding of this verse, I want to tell you that, you know, I'm clear on it in my mind, but I'm not dogmatic on it by any means. There are dozens of different viewpoints about what exactly Paul is saying in the first half of this verse. And many of them are very good, reasonable, logical understandings of that fit with the passage and fit with the whole context of what's going on here. So I want to say what I'm going to say, but I want you to understand. I say it with a little bit of carefulness, and if you really want to do some good, thorough, in depth, and I think intriguing research, you can dig out and work through this verse on your own. What it says in King James, it's translated, "Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing." And so, I'm going to give you my translation of it. But before I do that, let me explain two things here. There's a little word that's not. Excuse me. The little word "in." I lost my train of thought there. The little word "in" there, "be saved in childbearing," it's translated, it's not from the normal Greek word that we usually translate to be the word "in." Hang on, follow me here for just a second. There is a Greek word that is spelled E-E-N that usually translates to "in," I-N, in English. Not all the time, but most of the time. This Greek word is not "en," it's "dia," D-I-A. And it is sometimes translated "in." The vast majority of the time, it is translated "because" or "through." And so that word "in," it's not talking about "in" like we normally think of it, "in the process of." But it is, I would translate it "because of." And then there's a word in there that's not in the King James. And in fact, it's not in a lot of the translations. I'm not really sure why. But there, right in front of the word childbearing, there is the Greek word for the. So there is a the in front of childbearing. So let me give you Dave's translation of this verse. But she will be saved because of the childbearing. And I bet that just made everything a whole lot clearer to you, right? Yeah, exactly. So let me explain what I'm talking about here, why I think that works. Go back to verse 13. Paul says, "For Adam was first formed, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression, but she will be saved because of the childbearing." If you were to go back in your mind to Genesis chapter 3, in the middle of the whole account there of Eve's sin and Adam's sin, and then as God confronts Adam and Eve and the serpent, he confronts the serpent first, he curses the serpent, he confronts Eve and begins to issue the curses there, begins to issue the judgments there. But in the middle of that, in verse 15, there is a glorious promise that is interjected. And what God had told her is that part of the punishment was that the childbirth was going to be multiplied and it was going to be increased in pain. So that it was going to be a time of suffering and of pain. And then right after that, he gives this glorious promise that of the seed of the woman, there is going to come one who is going to crush the serpent. And I think Paul is pointing back to that point. I think Paul is referring these ladies back and reminding them, because he just reminded them about their sin, about the sin of Eve and the burden that is born because of it. And so now he interjects and says, but there is salvation because of the one who was born of the seed of the woman. But there is one that there is salvation because of that child that was promised, that was born. This is why I think this is a glorious verse. Because I think Paul is pointing to the Messiah. And he's saying, going all the way back to Genesis chapter 3 and that marvelous prophecy, and he's saying there's salvation because Christ has come. There's salvation because of the one who was born of a virgin for the salvation from sin. And so Paul concludes this, and he points them to their salvation, and then he calls them to right living. He calls them to continue in, to remain steadfast in faith, love, and holiness with a sound mind. That word sobriety is the same word that is in verse 9 that is translated sobriety. It's that same, that sound mind still, that you must, ladies, continue in faith and faithfulness to the Word of God. Continue steadfast in your faith. Continue living a life that is committed to the benefit of others. Living in love. Continuing in charity, as Paul says there, that you're living a life continuing in that commitment to do what is best for others. You're living a life of holiness, forsaking sin, putting on righteousness, and doing all of this with right biblical thinking so that your life is characterized by this faith and love and holiness and right thinking. And the whole point of the passage, ultimately, I think it's very straightforward. Your priority is not to show off your wealth, your style, your good taste, your diverse wardrobe, or your better judgment. Your priority must be to show off godliness, a life of faith that acts in love towards others, that lives in holiness, and that thinks biblically about all things. Paul's call is for you to be this kind of woman that operates, not just dresses, but in everything you do, acts in a manner that is fitting your profession of godliness. So I call you ladies this morning to be that kind of lady.